so much less afraid and so much more excited for sharing this work. Last but never least, thank you, Kelly Glenn Stacy, for loving me so well and making more than enough room for me to learn to love myself just as much. Thank you for rearranging your life to support my dream and holding me through it every step of the way. Everything's better when I'm with you and you are here with me. This is Ashley C. Ford. Thank you for listening to Somebody's Daughter.
This audiobook is published by Manila Press, an imprint of Bonnier Books UK.
This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos, recorded by Bryce Bowman, text copyright 2021 by Ashley Ford, production copyright 2021 by Macmillan Audio, all rights reserved.
And now, an interview with the author. Hey, everybody. I'm Clint Smith, and I'm the author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And more importantly, I am the dear friend of Ashley Ford, who I am thrilled to be here in conversation with.
Thank you, Clint. And hi, I'm Ashley C. Ford, the author of this book, Somebody's Daughter, here in conversation with my good friend, the brilliant Clint Smith.
Ashley, our books are our book siblings, as we like to call them, because they are coming out on the exact same day. They will forever have the same birthday, June 1st, 2021. And we have been writing and editing our books in a wild time in American history and world history. What has the experience for you been like writing this book over the course of the past few years, even though I know you've been thinking about it over the course of the past lifetime? What's that been like for you? And then what's it also been like for you over the past year during the pandemic?
Well, okay, let me start with the first part. And I think what it's been like for me working on this book over the past several years has been, I love the word that you use, not just and for your book, but, you know, the way you use the word about reckoning, it felt like a real reckoning. It felt like a personal reckoning. I definitely thought that I was going to be writing down a story that I had been thinking about for years and years and years, and turning my feelings and my experience into just like this little artifact, this little truth that I could hold on to. But it turns out that writing this book in particular, and I think this is true for most people who write memoirs, ended up revealing to me that even though I remembered a lot of the things that had happened to me, I had not actually worked through them or processed them, and I still needed to do that. So in the midst of working on the book and trying to form it into something that I wanted to share with the world, I was also sort of forming myself into someone that I wanted to share with the world. And over the past year or so, in the pandemic, it hasn't just been, you know, sit, write, edit. You know, I have all this time on my hands. Like, that's the thing I could do most. I definitely thought that that's what it would be like. But that was sort of the climax, you know, getting to the point where I was ready to turn this book over to my publisher was the climax of my realization of how deeply I still needed to care for myself, to be in a strong enough place to not just tell the truth, but to stand on it. Did you have a similar experience, Clint? Because I also feel like this past year, not to mention the last few years, have been a little mind-bending for you. I mean, I'm not surprised. I know how smart you are. I've been reading and watching you for a really long time. But sometimes I feel like you're a little surprised.
Yeah, the past few years have taken all sorts of twists and turns that have been unexpected in many ways. If you had told me several years ago that I would be writing a nonfiction book at all, that I would be a journalist at The Atlantic, that I would have two children. Those were not things that were on my radar. I mean, so, you know, I've been working on this book to varying degrees since 2017. And my son was born around the same time I started working on this book. And so my entire experience of working on how the word is passed has been animated by having young children. And so I have an almost 4-year-old. By the time this book comes out, he'll be 4, and a 2-year-old. And they are funny and delightful and opinionated and exhausting, right? Like all the things that small kids are. And so I think I quickly realized that any notion of having these long, extended periods of time in which I was going to write these sort of, you know, where I would be able to make myself a cup of tea, do some meditation, put some incense in the corner, water my plants, stretch, get ready, and like create these sort of rituals with which to write. That was not going to be something that was possible for me. You know, so much of this book was written in these small pockets of time when my daughter had fallen asleep on my chest and I'm typing into my laptop with one hand on the couch. They're during nap time. They're during episodes of Sesame Street. They are, you know, I would bring my laptop with me, and if both of my kids fell asleep in the car, I would pull over in the parking lot of a CVS or a Starbucks, and I would try to get 15 or 20 minutes in before they woke up. And so this book, I had a conversation with the writer and scholar Imani Perry, who also has two children and is as prolific a writer as I've ever known. And I was asking her, I was like, how do you do this? Like, how have you put this work out into the world and like been such a present mother and, you know, you teach at Princeton University and like, how have you? And she was like, you just have to disabuse yourself of the idea that you can only write for these, you know, long 2, 3, 4 hour periods. And you just, if you can write a paragraph here, that's great. If you can write a paragraph there, that's great. Because those add up, you know, even if it's just 15 or 20 minutes that you get at any given point. So logistically, that's how it worked. And I think in terms of the subject matter, I mean, part of what I loved so much about the process of writing this book was the surprise of it all. You know, the book is based on this idea about that there are different places across the country that reckon with or fail to reckon with their relationship to the history of American slavery. And I wanted to travel to all these different places to understand to what extent they were confronting their relationship to that history, to what extent they were running from it, and to what extent they were doing something in between. And it's one of those things where like you go to a place and you actually have no idea who the people you're gonna meet are. You have no idea what they're gonna say. You have no idea where it might lead you. Like there were some times when I went to a place that I thought I was going to write about, and that place actually led me to another place that I ended up writing about. And it was just, I kind of loved the idea that the book was taking me on a journey in the way that I hope it will take the reader, right? Like what I want is for the reader to feel like they are on this journey with me, because for me, it was a journey where at each place I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what those conversations would be or who I'd meet. And it kept surprising me. And it kept bringing up things that I could have never sort of imagined or come up with on my own. So I really love that part of the narrative nonfiction journey, especially in this sort of context. So Ashley, you and I have been talking about this book that's been in your head and in your heart for so long and for so many years before you even began writing it. How did you go about sort of pitching this book? Like, what was it like to try to condense this story that you were carrying into something that would make sense or that could be communicated to publishers? And how did the book evolve once you began writing it into what the listeners ultimately heard?
You know, what I didn't expect, and I don't know why, I feel like other people tried to tell me this, but for some reason I didn't believe it was true for me, is that the book you pitch just does not have to be the book you end up with.
Mm-hmm.
and that the book, the idea that you come up with initially, the framework, the outline, all of that is a starting place. And getting to the end requires not just sort of adhering to this list of things you want it to do. Books kind of become what they're going to be. Like the story reveals itself to you along the way, and you have to be willing to like tap into that and engage with that and hear that. So when I initially decided that it was time, I was going to finish my proposal, and I wanted to start reaching out with my agent to different editors at different publishing houses, I believe in every meeting I pitched this book as being about my relationship with my father. And that was the way I always thought of my book. I thought of my book up until it was very close to done as being about the relationship between me and my father, because I did not trust myself to go to the place that really went in depth in my relationship with my mother and other family members and even with myself. And my father seemed like a really easy person to sort of focus on, because I could write so much around my feelings and about, you know, what I had learned about the incarceration system. And it could be this memoir that ultimately wouldn't be about me, you know, and it wouldn't make me vulnerable, and it wouldn't put so much of me out there or my relationship with my mother that I would feel the need to defend myself or against the world, or, you know, like defend myself in conversations with my mother. And as I went along in the writing of this book, I realized how kind of deluded it was to think that I would be able to write about my childhood with very little mentioning of the effect the parent who raised me, who actually raised me, had. And I didn't want to do that. I knew I didn't want to paint anybody as a villain. I knew I didn't want anybody to be a hero or a savior. But I didn't know how much of the truth I would really allow myself to tell. And I just got to a point where I was like, tell it all. Tell it all. Tell it the way you want to tell it. Tell it in a way that makes sense in the narrative that you are, you know, sort of creating here. You know, and never forget that you are creating a narrative, and that there's a lot of responsibility with that. So the book evolved a lot. It went from being pretty much at arm's length, very distant from me, to being a very clear peek into a really complicated time of in my life, and how it, and I think it gives some indication how those experiences and circumstances still affect me.
I feel like I've read a lot of fiction lately that is based deeply on the lived experiences of the author, which we know has been the case for as long as people have been writing fiction. But, you know, yes, there's been a lot of discussion around autofiction, and I feel like I've read several novels lately that take a lot of material, a whole lot of material, if not most or all of it, from the writer's life, but it is presented in a fictional context. I've enjoyed listening to these writers discuss that choice, right? What the choice to make something a novel as compared to a memoir. And often what they say is that, well, there are a range of responses, but something they say is having the ability to shield certain people. Yes. having the ability to, you know, kind of insert a creative and narrative license in places where it might make the story better or robust, to create composite characters. And so I'm curious for you, you know, this book is so personal and mm-hmm. so striking. And I know that you've talked about one of the things that you had to do beyond the writing of it was like get to a point where you would, as you've mentioned, be okay telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think you said, even if that meant, I don't remember how you put it, but even if that meant you would hurt someone, or without holding back because of how it might make someone else feel. So all that's to say, I'm curious if you ever were tempted to make this a piece of fiction based on your life, so that you could, you know, either protect someone's identity or create composite characters, or if you were always and sort of remained throughout the process committed to this being a memoir.
I love that question, because the truth is, this story very much started as me wanting to write a novel that was informed by elements of my life. And really what changed that was that I took a college class. It was required for my major, creative nonfiction, with Jill Christman. And at the end of that semester, when Jill gave me my, you know, my C, which was a boon, right? Like, I got a C because I didn't turn in half of the homework. But she liked my writing, and I really liked her class. But at the end of that semester, she was going through, we had these conferences with her, and she was going through the work that I had turned in. And one of the things she told me was, this is a book. You know, like, this, everything you have here is a strong, strong start for the beginnings of a memoir. And, you know, at the time, I was 24, 25, like maybe. And I just felt like, no way. Like, there's no way. I remembered I had in the back of my mind, my growing up, and my mother saying something to me that was hurtful, or that was, you know, kind of mean. And one of the things that she would always say to me at some point was, don't think you're going to grow up and write a book about me. You know, don't think you're going to grow up and write a book about this. Don't be thinking you're going to do something like that. And I had it in my head that, like, writing about some of these things, even though, like, becoming a writer was something I tried to avoid, it didn't work out. I knew that she wouldn't like it. I knew that she would not be happy about it. My mom is very, very image conscious. And me having a say in what that image is, or adding to that image things that I see, does not fit into her picture, and she does not want it there. And I had to initially convince myself that it was okay to write these things, because maybe I would never publish them. And maybe even if I did publish them, she would never see them anyway. Maybe nobody would ever care, so it wouldn't be a big deal for me to just get it out. Mm. And as I journeyed through writing this thing and working on this thing and coming up with the ideas for this thing, I realized how impossible it would be to write this book and be concerned about what my mom would think of it, because it wasn't going to matter what I wrote, and it wasn't going to matter how I wrote it. What was going to matter was that it was not the same version of the past that she would like people to see when they thought about her past. So, as I continue to write, as I continue to think about my book, I realized And I learned, it's not even just like realized, like sometimes I hate saying realized because I don't want to make it sound like I was sitting there writing and had like a light bulb moment of enlightenment. It was, you know, through therapy, through reading books about adults who had dealt with the same things that I had dealt with as a kid. I learned that my feelings belong in any narrative about what happened to me. Like the way I saw things, the way I view things, the way I interpreted things is all valid. Like that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And as long as I am committed to telling the truth with kindness and without, you know, any sort of vindictiveness or maliciousness or anything like that, then I should feel free to tell the truth. And I should feel free to tell people about what happened to me. Because when you start hiding things about yourself, when you start keeping things about you under wraps, not because they are private or sacred to you, but because you are ashamed, you're essentially creating the environment inside of yourself for that shame to grow, for it to spread out into the world, and for it to hold you back in ways that you may not realize. And when shame is holding you back, the easiest thing to do is start blaming people around you for why you're being held up. Why you're being held back. And I don't mean like people like the man or the system, like, no, blame them. But your partner, your kids, your friends, it becomes they're not doing enough. If they were more, if they were better, I would feel better. I didn't want to do that to anybody that I loved and cared about. And I had wanted to stop doing it to myself. And the only thing that has ever helped me that has ever, ever, ever helped me bring that goal to fruition is telling the truth and letting people know how I feel, who I am, and what I come from. Mm. That was a lot. Mm. But, you know, that makes me think of your book, actually, Clint, because your book goes so far into the past, you know, and marries it to the present in such a brilliant and really, I think, innovative way. Like when I read your book, you know, I've read so many books about racism in America, about racial reckonings in America. And, you know, you go to read a book and you know it's going to be in Clint's voice, so it's not going to be the same as every other book. But I guess I just didn't expect for you to sort of, I guess the best way to say it is so seamlessly. I didn't expect for you to so seamlessly marry like what is happening now in the past, you know, and what we can look forward to in the future as part of that. So working on this book, I know that diving this deep into my past has absolutely changed my perception of what is possible for me and what is possible for my future, good and bad. And I wonder, after working on a book like this, how has it changed your perception of the future? What is possible? What you want to work toward in the future? What you hope we work toward as a country? Like, have those ideas shifted?
Yeah, you know, as you were speaking and you mentioned this idea of memory, and you mentioned how memory, your memory of an event, and this is one of the most fascinating pieces of memoir to me, is the an author's recognition that how they remember an event might be different from how the other person who was part of that same event also remembers it, or how the other people might remember it, right? Like it's an interesting sort of exercise to imagine, like, you know, I think of so many of those scenes in your book, and like, How would your mother remember that scene? How would your brother remember that scene? How would your sister remember that scene? Like what was, because our memories are shaped and informed by our own experiences, our identities, our sensibilities, and all of those make us engage with people or places or moments in different ways and make sense of those things in different ways. And you're speaking to sort of an interpersonal aspect of that. And I think what my book is trying to do is explore the sort of historical manifestations of that, right? This question of collective memory and how do we, as a society, as a country, and as individuals, remember or fail to remember the way that slavery has shaped what our contemporary landscape of inequality looks like today. And part of what I discovered is that, you know, I remember, for example, going to one of my chapters is about Blandford Cemetery, which is one of the, in Petersburg, Virginia, it's one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country. The remains of 30,000 Confederate soldiers are buried there. And I went during the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. So I was a conspicuous presence, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And what was so fascinating to me was having the conversations with these Sons of Confederate Veterans and these people dressed in Confederate regalia who, you know, were singing the Dixie anthem, who were, you know, marching in front of all of these tombstones with their bayonets in the air, who were calling people who wanted to take down Confederate statues the American version of ISIS. And to go and have these conversations with them and to try to understand how they can be on the same plot of land as I am and understand what that land is in a way that is fundamentally different than I do. And that the way that we make sense of what that place is deeply tied to our lineage, is deeply tied to our sense of self, is deeply tied to sort of micro and macro histories that shape who we understand we are in the world. And part of what I learned is that like so much of history is a story that people tell about the past, right? And it relies less on any sort of empirical or historical evidence as much as it relies on a narrative, as much as it relies on someone's sense of their own identity, their own family or community's identity being at stake in any rewriting of the past. I think that's why we see so much of the blowback and pushback that we do today against, you know, the efforts to think more critically about issues of race and gender and sexual orientation and immigration and you know, all of these things that we've, you know, for so long we had been inundated with very specific notions of what things should look like or what things should be or what they have been. Mm-hmm. And now you have more people recalibrating and reimagining and re-excavating, you know, questions of the past so that we can more fully understand how we've arrived at this moment and how we can move toward a more equitable and just future. You know, I think that part of what has to happen is that our collective memories in this country are so scattered, mm-hmm. right? Like there's not a cohesive, it's not necessarily cohesive, but the tension of this country is that we are in many ways like profoundly heterogeneous, right? Like there are people from all sorts of different walks of life, all sorts of backgrounds. And as a result, there's not really a cohesive story that is told about this country because so many people experience the country in such different ways. But I think there are some things like slavery, we know what happened, right? And what happened, and then after the Civil War, the Lost Cause ideology and the Lost Cause movement attempted to rewrite a history of what happened. Lost Cause, you know, former Confederates said that the war wasn't about slavery. When after they seceded, they had said it, or while they seceded, they were saying it for themselves, right? All you have to do is look at the declarations of Confederate secession, and you see a statement like Mississippi that says, you know, in 1861, our interests are thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material good in the world, right? Like, so we don't have to wonder why the Civil War was fought, because they said it, right? But part of what happens is that because people's sense of themselves and sense of their lineages and the stories of their grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents is tied up in something that we now largely understand as having been monstrous. Mm-hmm. People attempt to rewrite the story in order to absolve those people, really in order to absolve themselves, right?
Yes. Yes.
And the question is, to what extent are people going to be willing to reject the idea that what their ancestors may have done somehow implicates them, and that they, rather than being something that they can directly confront and interrogate and say, this thing was done, and that is a shameful part of my history. And that is a shameful part of my lineage. And that's a hard thing for people to say, right? I mean, I think you spoke to this idea, like it's a hard thing for people to write in memoirs, like to write about shameful things that have happened to them or shameful things that people they love, you know, have done. And I think that question of shame is often at the center of it. And it really ultimately what happens is, to what extent are people willing to confront this shame versus to what extent are they attempting to make excuses for it. You know, it's a, that's the question.
That is the question. I have another question for you real quick, because one of the things that I've actually always hoped that I'd get the chance to like sit down and talk to you about is the Whitney Plantation. Mm. And I visited the Whitney Plantation in 2018. Yes, early 2018, I visited the Whitney Plantation. And I remember my guide telling me that it was the only plantation that did tours from the perspective of slave life and from what it would have been like to be a slave on that plantation or an enslaved person. And it started to make me think about how hard it is to know what it, like, what did it feel like until I was in that place, to be perfectly honest. And it was the first time I'd ever been on a plantation or done anything like that in that capacity. Until I was in that place, I could not really fathom what it would have been like to be in one of those rooms, you know, like in one of those shacks, what it would have been like to be punished by being put in, you know, a metal cage in the sun, you know, and you walk into that cage in that hot Louisiana weather, and it's like, what? Like, how did a person survive? How did this happen? And I think about that a lot in terms of just our lineage as Black folks in this country. I very recently, actually, after I finished How the Word is Passed, I was able to check out my family line, being finally, I was able to go back further than my great grandparents, and I was able to see names and dates and where these people lived beyond that, and got back to a plantation in Alabama, specifically on my father's side. And was able to see some of the information about my, you know, ancestor who was living in those circumstances. And I just kept thinking, how come more of these experiences, and like, I know why. I know that like it's traumatic, it's shameful, people don't want to talk about it. But so much of these stories have not been passed down even through family. You don't hear about your great-great-grandparent who went through this or that or this time or that time. Nobody talks about it. When my grandmother passed away, she had written out in a notebook all of these things she wanted me to know about her childhood and all these things she wanted me to know about where she came from. And it occurred to me that she probably had not done that for my mother and that nobody had done that for her or for her mother or for her mother's mother. And I'm wondering, how do we not necessarily have a cohesive, collective memory, but how do we pass on these stories in a way that allows the people who come behind us, who come after us, to process what has happened before they arrived? What happened that people regularly experienced in their family or in their bloodline that they'll never know about, that they'll never experience? How do we allow those stories to transfer without transferring the trauma of those stories? Is that possible?
I don't know. I don't know. I think you've so sort of poignantly laid out the memories of that time are so intrinsically intertwined with that trauma. And I think for many Black folks of certain generations, there was not always, but sometimes an effort to leave that behind as much as possible, right? And as a protective mechanism, right? As a means of like, I have to move forward with my life and I need to figure out how to not be so weighed down by the just like unimaginable trauma of what chattel slavery was. I mean, you know, we all know slavery was bad, right? Like we're taught from a young age, slavery was bad. We did this terrible, you know, this country did this terrible thing. And, you know, we're also taught that it was a long, long time ago when it actually wasn't. You know, there are people who are alive today who loved and learned from, had relationships with, were raised by people who had been born into bondage. You know, I think all the time about my three-year-old son and watching him sit on my grandfather's lap. And I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that my grandfather's grandfather is someone who was born into bondage. And I'm in those moments, the sort of our collective proximity to that period of time feels so much closer than what we're often told it is. And that this history that we're told happened a long time ago wasn't in fact that long ago at all. And I think that there have been people, part of the issue is that there's a lack of documentation generally that make it difficult for people to trace their own lineage. A lot of Black folks to trace their own lineage in many ways because Black people weren't even included on the census until 1870. And then, so that's the sort of logistics part of it. But even sort of psychologically and emotionally, you know, I did a piece for The Atlantic about the Federal Writers Project, which was a 1930s, late 1930s New Deal initiative by, this is my son banging on the door.
Hi!
Hold on.
I told you, man, when they have kids, kids are on their own time. They're on their own time. Kids are like, I don't care what you're doing. I love it.
You can say hello, and then you have to leave. Say hi. They're not on video, so you have to, you just hear them. Say hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What's their name?
Ashley.
Hello.
Ashley's my friend. Do you want to say hi, Ashley?
Hi, Ashley.
Hi, buddy. How are you?
Good.
Good.
So we're having a meeting right now, so I need you to go back downstairs, all right? Come on.
I get it, man. Sometimes you just want to play with your dad.
What was I saying? Federal Writers Project.
Yes, you were talking about the Federal Writers Project.
Yes.
And I had asked about, we were talking about it, like, not passing on, how to tell stories without passing on trauma. Yeah.
So I actually was working on a piece for The Atlantic about the Federal Writers Project, which was a late 1930s New Deal initiative that was in part committed to getting the oral histories and interviewing the formerly enslaved folks who were still alive between 1936 and 1938. And they got over 2,300 interviews from people who had been born into slavery, and many of whom had lived as children throughout the period of slavery until emancipation. And something that came up in a lot of those conversations with descendants was the way that so few people in their family had talked about it, right? And it was just part of what came up again and again was like, it was too painful. It was too painful for people to discuss. It was almost this thing that we're like, we don't want to go back to that. We don't want to move past it. And you know, there were millions of people who were enslaved who obviously have tens of millions of descendants. And so the experience of any given family is going to be different. But for many families, I know that there was almost a concerted effort not to discuss it. You know, I think the trauma of those who experienced it was so profound and almost, you know, and then from future generations, sometimes a desire to move away from it as quickly as possible. And, you know, part of what I try to do in the book is I sit down and interview my grandparents because I realize that I bring a level of, I've for so long as a researcher, as a writer, as a journalist, I've brought so much intentionality to interviewing strangers about their lives and haven't really brought that same level of intentionality to my own family. And I wanted to change that. And I've become sort of obsessed with oral histories and have just learned so much. Like I'd known my mother for 32 years and I don't think I ever knew, or maybe I wasn't paying good enough attention, but like, I don't think I knew that she had been among the first to integrate her school, you know? And my mother was born in 1959. And so, you know, there's so much history that's still with us of people who experienced these profound and often shameful moments in American history. And I think we have to do all that we can to collect these stories before these folks pass away. And speaking of stories and oral histories and sort of oral testimonies, you know, we read our books out loud, which was a wild process. And I'm curious to hear about, you know, you've talked about how emotional the writing process was and the sort of personal excavation that you had to do in order to even begin the writing. What was it like saying these words out loud?
It was definitely more emotional and more intense than I had anticipated. And I'm not sure how much I could have anticipated it. but I certainly just didn't expect, after writing these words, after, you know, deleting a bunch of words, coming back and writing more words, editing those words again, you know, after all of that, I just could not imagine that I was going to come sit in this booth and read from my iPad and be overcome with emotion. Like, I just thought, I'm through with that now, which is a lesson I have to keep learning, is that you're not really through with these things as much as you learn how to work through them and eventually trust that you will make it to the other side of this emotional experience so that you don't have to panic at the beginning. It was hard, Clint. It was really hard. You know, I had I am recording our conversation in the same studio where I recorded the rest of my audiobook over the course of 3 days. Mm-hmm. And like this little room will probably always be a little special to me now because I had a very, very emotional moment more than once in this room. And I felt so cared for in those moments. And I felt really surrounded in my headphones, you know, and even around me by like good energy and just like I felt supported. And I think that that was something, that was a moment for me. It was a moment because I spent a lot of time working on this book and not accepting comfort when I needed it, not seeking comfort when I needed it. And when I sat here reading out loud and feeling overcome, you know, there was comfort in snacks and tea and kind words and all of that, just like an acknowledgement that I was having the experience, you know, and I felt all this comfort. And it occurred to me that even two years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. 2 years ago, I would have like had that emotional moment in this studio, and I would have been so embarrassed by it that I would have asked to leave for the rest of the day, at the very least. You know, like I would have not wanted to look people who saw me or heard me have that moment in the eye. And I just don't have that kind of embarrassment anymore about my emotional processes and about, you know, crying or seeking comfort or receiving it. I don't have shame around that anymore because the shame that I had was never mine. It never belonged to me. Mm. And it only kept me from one of the best things about being a human, which is that you have other humans you can count on and who feel you and who will connect with you when you need it most.
Best thing about being a human is that you have other humans.
It is.
That's a bar right there.
What about you? I remember seeing a photo of you that you posted on Instagram when you were done recording your audiobook and you just looked exhausted. Like, I think even the picture, you were almost posed exhausted. Like, oh my goodness. So how did it go?
Whew, it was intense. I mean, I have so much respect for audiobook narrators. I mean, it's interesting because I've done podcasts for years. I have, I give talks and readings and keynotes and speeches all the time. It was hard. It was really hard. I think what's interesting, the process of reading it, for me at least, is that I would read a sentence and then realize that like I put the emphasis on the wrong word. And orally, part of what happens is that you realize if you say it's like I went to the store and the mall versus I went to the store and the mall versus mm-hmm. I went to the store and the mall, right? Like all those sentences mean fundamentally different things.
Yes.
And so I was reading it and I was like, oh, I need to say it this way and not that way. But it almost meant that I was repeating every line of the book like 3 times to try to like figure out how I was actually supposed to say it. Mm-hmm. I know that might not be everybody's experience, but I my book's about 100,000 words or so. And I probably read all of those words 3 to 4 to 5 times. I am an inelegant reader. Shout out to the producers and the editors who make it sound very seamless. And like, I just kind of glided through because I did not glide through. But I haven't listened to the whole thing. I've listened to the first chapter, And, you know, part of what for me was the concern going in was like, it wasn't necessarily the, whether it was going to be an emotional process as much as I wanted to, you know, I think professional narrators often will change their voice and intonation and take on the voices of characters in the book. Like certainly yeah. they do that in fiction. And I think even in a lot of narrative nonfiction, the best audiobook narrators are, they're often also actors, and they will, you know, have a voice of a character that they carry on throughout the book. I am not an actor. I am far from it. And so I didn't want to make caricatures of people's voices, you know? So I had to figure out how to make the people's voices distinct from my own voice, the narrator's voice, but also, you know, not make it so that I'm trying to replicate what their voice is. And I had to find that balance between like shifting my intonation or like making it clear that there was like a tonal shift or some signal to the reader that this was now someone else's quote rather than my own voice, or someone mm-hmm. else's voice rather than my own voice, without, you know, trying to speak with the drawl that someone else might have, that I might've described someone as having in the book, or a certain accent that they might've had, just because I've listened to books where some authors have tried to do that. And I just don't trust myself in well enough to do it without making it sound too close to mockery, if that makes sense. So that was the interesting part for me. But I'm glad I did it. It was a grind. I mean, you were in the studio 3 days. I was in the studio 6 days, in part because I kept, you know, it took me like 30 minutes to do, I feel like, you know, a couple pages. But
you also have a longer book.
You know, that's generous of you. That's a generous framing. So we'll go with that. I think a question that a lot of memoirists get is whether the people in their lives who are described in the book have read the book. And I am curious, you know, given what we've discussed, given the honesty with which you write, have your father, your mother, your grandmother, your siblings, have they read the book? Have you talked to them about the book? Will they read the book? Do you want them to? Like, how do you think about that?
You know, I sort of acquiesce to the fact that some of them are going to read it, right? I don't know that that's my preference, but I know that they will. And the only reason why I would have the preference for some of them not to read the book would be because I know them well enough at this point to know what they will see when they read my book. And it's like, will you read the whole book and you know, see me? You know, even as you see yourself reflected back at you through my eyes, like, will you still be able to see me through that, or will you not? And there are members of my family who I absolutely think will be able to read this book and see me, even as they see themselves reflected back to themselves. There are other members of my family where I think that will not be true. I think my dad absolutely will read it. He is very excited to read it, and I am excited to give it to him, but I want to give it to him in person, and we're still getting vaccinated. I've got shot one, waiting on shot two, and once we're vaccinated, I plan to go see my dad and give him the book in person and talk to him about it that way. My mother, it is, or at least it seems to me, to be a better idea to essentially let her decide if she wants to read it or if she doesn't. And if she wants to read it, she can, you know, ask me for a copy. She can procure her own copy if that's more comfortable for her. And then I leave the door open for us to talk about it, whether she feels good about it or not. With my siblings, I think my sister will read it. I think my brothers will say they will and absolutely won't. and the other members of my family, you know, it's there's so many of us that I know some people will, some people won't. And with everybody, I leave the door open. You can come talk to me about it. We can discuss it. But what I am not going to do is compromise my truth. I can share my truth with kindness, but I do not compromise. I have to be able to hold on to myself and my sense of self and trust myself, because what I struggle with is letting those things slip away. Essentially, pulling myself out of consideration so that there is more room to consider other people and their experiences and their emotions. And I did not just do all the work I had to do on myself to get this book done and to feel good about getting it done, just to allow myself to, you know, go backwards in that direction. So I feel ready for the conversations that will inevitably come. But so far, I have not had to have many of those conversations.
Mm. I'd be so curious to see how it all unfolds.
Me too. What's the biggest takeaway that you want readers or listeners to learn from your book? Because I know that I finished your book and A, felt like I wanted to read like four or five other books after reading your book, but also felt like this charge, like it made me feel, I feel like for me, it almost gave my memoir a little more purpose because I started to feel this sense of, wow, I can't believe that I get to record my own story this way and record my own circumstance. And I know that, you know, if nothing else, like books come and go and disappear sometimes. But my story, like the story that I've told here, as long as somebody has a copy of this book, then my voice matters. And it's always part of this, like, conversation. And there are so many people, I'm realizing now, who just never got the chance. And not because they weren't interested, but because it either wasn't safe or because they had been so properly traumatized and shamed, or there had been, you know, campaigns against their right to share their story, to tell what's going on. So that's what I got from it, was like, it's so important for us to record our stories. It's so important for us to tell our stories. Like, we don't know where they end up, and we don't know how helpful they can be down the line to people who come after us. But in general, when people come to your book, what do you want them to walk away with?
I mean, honestly, as a writer, what you just said is far more interesting than anything I would have to say. Mm. And almost far more important, right? Like, I think, and you know this, that as writers, we create something and then we put it out into the world. And it's ours, but it's also not ours anymore, yeah. Right? Like, in the same way that different people come to a different historical site or a different piece of land, a different monument or museum, and experience that place, experience the same place in fundamentally different ways based on who they are and what their life experiences are and what their identities are. I think art and I think literature is the same way, right? So, you know, even in these sort of with early readers, before the book has even come out, it's so fascinating to me to hear the different ways that people have made sense of it, and to hear what other people's takeaways of it. It's kind of like when somebody asked me, you know, as a poet, I speak to a lot of high schools, you know, high school students who have read my book, or college students, and they often say, like, in this poem, what did you mean? Or in this line, what did you mean? Or what is this poem about? And I tell them it's far more interesting to me to hear what you think it's about, because it almost doesn't matter what I think it's about. What's more interesting to me is how, you know, this classroom of 20 kids can read the same poem and all take something so different away from it. And I imagine that in some ways my book and your book will be the same, right? Like the way that your takeaway from the book and the way that you put it in conversation with the sort of lineage and tradition of Black memoirs that your work is a part of, right? I mean, if we really think about the history of Black literature in this country, arguably the memoir is in some ways the richest part of our culture's literary lineage. I mean, if you think from, like, you know, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, you think of Harriet Jacobs, you think of, you know, in the early days of slavery, all the way through a book like Somebody's Daughter. I mean, the memoir and the autobiography have often been the mechanism by which Black folks have provided both a window into a set of experiences that people might not otherwise know about, and also a mirror for other Black folks to look and see themselves in something that they might not otherwise have seen themselves in before, right? And to, you know, I love that feeling of reading something and it saying something that I always felt but never knew how to say. And that's so powerful. And I think the best memoirs both act as window and mirror. And I think yours does so beautifully. And so, you know, I had never considered that part of how my own book is in conversation with that idea, right? And the idea of the memoir being, I don't want to say an act of resistance necessarily, because I think that phraseology can become sort of overused, even if well-intentioned, but that it is...
Reclamation?
A reclamation, right? And that it is a means of asserting agency, and like emotional agency, psychological agency, and obviously literary agency in ways that are so important and have not always been allowed to us.
Yes.
So all that's to say, your answer is my answer. Because that's what I'm most interested in.
I love that. I love that. And I think I feel similarly. I think I feel in a lot of ways so interested in how people will react to the book and what they will find in it. I've gotten such amazing feedback, especially from other Black women. Oh my God, especially from other Black women. And, you know, in some cases, in just women in general, I've gotten this affirming and encouraging feedback about my book in terms of, you know, because for me, it's not necessarily that I need people to say, you know, it's a great book. I don't want people to walk away being like, Ashley is a great writer. I want them to walk away feeling like, man, Ashley made me feel something in this book. And I don't know what that feeling is going to be for everybody. But I know that if I can make people feel things with words, then I can make them feel me. Like, I can not even make them, but I can help them feel me. I can help them connect with me if the interest is there. And I want people to know, ultimately, that, like, there is nothing that really I can do that nobody else can do. Like, it's not – it might be great and it might be a good experience, but it is not unique in my ability to do it, or in my right to do it. I think a lot of people feel that they don't have the right to write about themselves and about their lives. And I want them to know that that's not true. That if anything, that is your, like, that is one of your most divine rights, to tell your own story and to express yourself artistically.
I think that's a mic drop right there. I can't think of a better place to end.
I think that's great. Clint, thank you so much for talking with me about your book, talking with me about my book, and just taking the time out of your day to have a conversation with a friend.
It has been a joy. It has been a pleasure for me, and clearly for my son, who could not stay outside, but was obviously eavesdropping on all of the gems you were dropping. So it has been it's been a real pleasure, and I know that we'll talk soon.
We will. Thanks, bud.
Always.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.